Logged On.
Welcome to Logged On, a monthly podcast from Dazed about all things internet culture, from memes to emerging trends, deep web conspiracy theories, and beyond. I'm your host, Gunseli Alchinkaya, and this episode we have two very special guests, Amy Ireland and Maya Chronic. Amy and Maya are the authors of an upcoming book on urbanomic titled Cute Accelerationism, which looks at cuteness through a philosophical lens, breaking it down into squishy segments through the natural, cultural, sensory, technical, and libidinal. I first came across Amy and Maya's Cute Accelerationism at last year's Unsound Festival in Krakow, where they did a presentation cementing their status as experts in the growing field of cuteness studies. As for the book itself, I've been fortunate enough to read a proof ahead of the release and can highly recommend. Aside from providing perhaps the most conclusive breakdown of cuteness out there, what I also love about this book, purely for aesthetic reasons, is how cute it looks. It's pink, small, chubby, it's a little text. I definitely recommend that everyone keeps an eye out for it. So for this episode, we're looking at cuteness, or more specifically, how cuteness has become the dominant aesthetic of our modern times. In the past month alone, we've seen the opening of Cutes, an exhibition at London's Somerset House, and the 50th anniversary of Hello Kitty, arguably one of the most recognisable mascots of cuteness out there. In the past few years, we can observe the infectious power of cuteness all across culture, both online and offline, from celebrities like Dua Lipa wearing Hello Kitty bikinis on Instagram, the Hello Kitty Crocs collection, the Pokemon Fendi collection, as well as countless internet things about catboys, fairies, coquette as a dominant fashion aesthetic with its pink satin bows, and also the return of OG street style Bible Fruits magazine. I also wrote an article last year about e-girls entering the military, which kind of ties into a subsect of this. So if anyone's interested, I recommend people read that after this podcast. But yeah, maybe before we kick things off properly, let's do a quick fire round. So Maya, Amy, welcome to the podcast. What are some things that you've been finding cute recently?
I've just been watching lots of cute anime. I've been really getting into Moe Dempa anime, which is like a weird kind of mix of cute characters with Dempa aesthetic, which is like, Dempa means electromagnetic waves in Japanese. And it's kind of like got this paranoid, socially isolated, alienated, unreal kind of edge to it. So yeah, I've been watching stuff like Puella Magi Madoka Magica, and Lane, of course, is like the kind of like exemplary type of Dempa Moe anime.
Yeah, love Lane. When everyone was getting Lane pilled last year on TikTok, I was watching very intensely.
I've been following fox accounts on Instagram. I think cute foxes are a really interesting one because it kind of speaks in a way to the fact that no one's immune from cuteness, because you have these animals that are kind of loner, outsider animals who don't usually communicate with humans and usually keep a distance. And they've been turned into these kind of affectionate pets. So that's kind of interesting to watch. And then the other one is Finicky's puppy. I don't know if you know Finicky.
Oh, yeah. No, what is it?
This is like basically a gender nonconformist YouTube power couple. So Finster was a Minecraft YouTuber who decided to wear girls' clothes for a bet. And kind of transformed from there. Icky was a trans model, and they got together last year, and it was an extremely cute episode. And then they moved in very quickly, and now they've got a puppy. So I've been watching that with great delight.
Maybe it's worth kind of getting into a bit of context surrounding cuteness before we get into the meat of it. So as you point out in the book, the origins of the word cute come from acute, which kind of denotes sharpness. It also has extreme connotations, like if something's acute, it's kind of experienced to an intense degree, which I think has a lot of overlaps with what we'll be kind of getting into shortly in a bit. It was first shortened to cute in the 18th century, but it was only in the post-war period that cuteness really took hold, with social industrial changes giving way to technological advances and mass production that allowed toys and books to be made easily and cheaply. It wasn't until the 90s, however, that cuteness as kawaii in Japan at the same time, which kind of took hold at the same time as the country's economic crash, kind of started making its way over to the West, taking hold globally through anime and manga, which was kind of strategically pushed by Japanese companies into international markets at the time. So I guess we've been seeing this cuteness, like cuteness as an idea, really. I feel like it was after the pandemic that it started kind of entering the mainstream consciousness as such. I remember back in 22 writing about cuteness and like its relationship with nostalgia, kind of like the main points of reference where I guess Marc Jacobs' Heaven was really taking off around then, Drain Gang, PC Music, all these kind of internet native fashion trends and music trends really embodied this cuteness, which seemed really inextricable to, I guess, Y2K. And like, I guess a lot of Y2K toys are really kind of innately cute as well. So yeah, I guess there is one lens through which we can understand the recent cultural explosion of cuteness, which is through an escapist lens. But as you mentioned, the book and as a Somerset House exhibition does a good job at demonstrating as well, there's so much more to cuteness than simply nostalgia, and the growing role of the internet in our everyday lives plays a huge role in this as well, obviously. So for you both, what is it about today's extremely online age that makes cuteness such a dominant aesthetic, both online and offline?
I think that's definitely an aspect of it, a kind of nostalgic escape from a disappointing, exploitative, and even dangerous present. But I think it's missing something really important about cute to just see it as a kind of retreat into a past golden era. Like, I think a really good way to kind of make this distinction is to compare cuteness to twee fashion, for example. So like, twee is, I think, really just a purely conservative, nostalgic aesthetic. It likes natural things, it's sentimental, it likes authentic human connection, actual vintage objects, all kinds of materials, fashion, quaint old-fashioned activities, typewriters, Holga cameras, Peter Pan collars, doing things like bird watching or whatever. Whereas cute, the nostalgia that comes with cute isn't a nostalgia for an actual past historical period or even for your own real childhood. It's a nostalgia for some kind of unrealized moment. And I think that's really important because what our pandemic and sort of growing over the past few decades obsession with cuteness seems to show is like a desire for a different kind of world. And it's this desire that comes with cuteness that I think actually makes a space for an interesting kind of transformation to happen. And that's happening in the very first instance, I think, online with our images of ourselves and the way that we relate to our physical bodies as well. So I think there's definitely like a nostalgic aspect to it, but it's a really kind of interesting, productive nostalgia.
Yeah, and I think we could speak about all kinds of causes of why cute has entered the cultural sphere so aggressively in the last few years. And we could go back to like the post-war years in Japan and so on. But I think for us, what we realized early on is that we didn't really know what cute was, and we had to treat it as a problem. We had to assume that we didn't know what it was. So we see cute as this kind of UFO or a kind of alien signal that humans at some point have stumbled across. And through our interactions with it, we're continually refining our understanding of cute. We're continually constructing and reconstructing what we think cute is. We're continually exploring different strains of cuteness. But at the same time, it's doing something to us, and we really don't know what it's doing to us. So we understand it as a process rather than as a fixed thing and as a transformative force in the world. And this is why, really, we'll only be able to understand cute from the future, not from the past.
Yeah, and again, in the book, one line that really got me is, wait, what was it? It was, cute thrives not only because of the internet, but because of how it allows us to live in a world that is moving increasingly online. And again, in the Somerset House exhibition, in the text, they write, there's no doubt that the internet is cute's 21st century engine. Which I guess got me thinking about all those early examples, especially with anime being used in early messaging boards like 2chan and 4chan, and also early memes like Neon Cat, Caramella Girls, like those three anime girlies with the cat is dancing to Nightcore. I mean, like, even Nightcore itself, like as a music genre with its sped up sounds and anime aesthetic, like it all just feels cute. So, yeah, I guess, what is it about the internet, especially the early internet, that made it such an incubator for cuteness?
I think that, kind of going back to this sort of late 20th century, 90s nostalgia kind of stuff that you were evoking, I think it's really interesting to think about it against the background of this like cyber feminist critique of web 2.0. So like the visual web where we're all posting photos and it's very image based, as being this kind of like sad regression from the old days of web 1.0 where everything was text based. Because the idea was like when everything was text based, when you went into a forum or a multi-user dungeon or whatever, you didn't have to be the person that you were in your other life. There's lots of stories of people experimenting with identity, with gender. And it was sort of seen, for better or for worse, as a really kind of emancipatory place because no one really knew who anyone else was. And so they were like, when the visual internet came online, everything got really real. And it was all about representing everyone's boring lives as they really are. And then that kind of became entangled in this critique in the early Instagram days of like people, you know, representing their lives in a way that was much more rosy than they really were and creating this kind of runaway mimetic desire or whatever. But I think we've gone past this point now where so many people have access to image editing software. People have skills to be able to edit images really well. We can generate completely synthetic new images using AI. And we've moved beyond, like, I'm sorry to say for the old guard, but we've moved beyond the like paradigm of truth. There's no way we can put all of this back in the box. Like trying to enforce this kind of like truth versus post-truth paradigm, it's a lost cause. We have to instead figure out how to live in the post-truth world. So we've got all of a sudden this kind of return through the visual, like going through it and coming out the other side, to what was so great about the text-based internet. The fact that you can go online and even though you're posting an image of yourself or a video or whatever, you're creating a representation of yourself that is something you want to be, or playing with your identity or exploring possibilities in a way that's just as effective as, you know, typing your gender as something different in the like multi-user dungeon in the 90s. So I think that there's this kind of like interesting flip where the digital world is actually, cuteness is like primed to use the digital world for whatever its purposes are in a way that is really interesting. And it's kind of like taking us beyond the old paradigms of the internet and the way that we engage with visual media. Also, apologies for my voice. I'm recovering from an epic bout of COVID and having a lot of trouble speaking. So sorry, everybody.
I think there's also an adjacency of cute to all of the discourses about girling and, you know, we're all a girl on the internet, because cute really opens up a kind of space for a different subject position, which has certain affordances and which opens the way to certain different types of relations with others, with oneself, with technology, and with kind of self-transformations. I mean, one of the starting points actually for the book was when we started to look at how trans communities online often involved the objectification of oneself as an image, as part of a process of transformation. So like making yourself cute. So in many senses, going back to the question of why now, we are living in very uncute times in many senses. And it could be that we see cuteness as a kind of retreat into safety and triviality. And indeed, like some critiques of cute suggest that, you know, it's just a retreat into kind of trivia and safety. And it's merely to do with passive consumption. But what we've seen is really there's the radical potential in cute insofar as it's not simply about consumption, because cuteness is a process. And what's interesting about the process of cuteness is it tends to make consumers produce themselves as cute in turn. It's quite hard. It's quite hard to appreciate cute without eventually wanting to become cute. And this cuteness process, we see at work in all kind of transformative ways on the online. So eventually we got to the point where we talk about three circuits of cuteness. The first circuit is this kind of evolutionary model of where cuteness evolves as a kind of receptivity to certain features. The second circuit is consumer capitalism, where you have this kind of civilization scale experiment of refining, producing cuter and cuter objects. The third circuit, where we are now, is really interesting because you have people who, within their own lifetime, are transforming themselves, producing themselves as cute objects for others. And the communities who are doing that are then driving demand for even more technology to be able to transform themselves.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's that bit in cute accelerationism where you're talking about how we interact with the digital, which is through a two-dimensional plane. Like, I guess whether it's through pictures of ourselves or others or avatars, memes, bitmojis even, we are for the most part interacting with flatness, which then feeds back into the material world and our understanding of ourselves off screen. Like, I was watching this TikTok the other day about cartoonification, which I guess kind of touches on similar themes of how we're seeing all these 2D things, these things on our screens leak out into the kind of quote-unquote real world, like whether that's through pixelated clothing in Paris Fashion Week or like even those Mischief Astro Boy boots, like those red chubby boots that come from like Astro Boy the manga but went viral last year when Mischief like created the real version of those. And yeah, it really does feel like this kind of recursive feedback loop of sorts.
Yeah, we talk about flat maxing, which is like the idea that we're kind of optimizing ourselves to appear in the best light possible on a two-dimensional screen. And that's kind of altering our perception of ourselves. And there's a whole kind of interesting theme in the book to do with flatness and 2D love.
It's also like there's this interesting interplay between, you know, this thing from manga, these boots, being something that belonged to the fictional world, becoming real or becoming materialized. And so the 2.5D, like you're kind of saying, is like this space that exists between the 2D and the 3D, or this discursive fictional world and the, you know, what we kind of tend to call the real world or the material world. But I think that what is actually happening is that this bringing out of two-dimensional discursive visual online culture of objects that get materialized in the 3D material world is actually just eroding the distinction altogether. So there's not this kind of there's no kind of meaning to saying like that's not real anymore, because if it's not real now, it's possible, quite likely, that it's going to become real in the future. So cuteness is aiding this kind of like feedback loop between the fictional and the real that dissolves the distinction altogether.
Yeah, and I think the fact that that large-scale transformation is being driven by the most apparently superficial parts of culture is something that many of the analysts of cuteness really haven't got a hold of, because they're still working in a kind of 20th century paradigm of cultural criticism.
Yeah, so true, because yeah, like we do kind of create our own realities online, like especially with social media. I kind of like to see it as a live action role play for the most part. And yeah, I don't know, this might be a bit of an out there take, but I've been thinking recently, I really do see cuteness in some sense as its own psychedelic plane of sorts, in that, yeah, like everything we do online exists outside of the material world. It does, like you do see this blurring, as you said, of like fiction and reality. And cuteness and the way that we kind of digest cuteness online and the way that we understand reality like through this lens really does lend itself to that kind of world building, I guess, just instead of like tie-dye and crystals. We're seeing Sanrio and emojis. Like, I know, I also think even the fact that cuteness kind of came around at the same time as capitalism, where we get this boom of toys and objects entering circulation, but it was only really at the dawn of the internet in the 90s that it really goes global. So yeah, why do you think that is? Like, why is cuteness as an aesthetic like so infectious?
I think it's cuteness is a modernist category even. So it's, we just don't have a concept of it before the early to mid 20th century. And I think it's kind of part of this thing. I was listening to this lecture the other day by Mark Fisher, where he's talking about popular modernism. So this kind of culture that is coming from the bottom up, it's not coming from the academy. It's not coming from like the institutional cultural gatekeepers. It's coming from everyday people who are just like making music in their bedrooms and making memes in their bedrooms. And I think that the internet, because of its accessibility, its widespread, like now, cultural status, and the fact that, you know, it's cheaper to spend a night in gaming than it is to go out and do something that's more traditionally cultural, is why you get this culture coming from these kind of disenfranchised spaces. The internet empowers everyday people to make culture and gives it a platform. And I think that cute is also a popular aesthetic. And so those two things come together to make it ultra contagious.
A lot in the book about cuteness as this evolutionary trap. And it's definitely true, I guess, going back to the rounded features, the big eyes, even the way that we interact with cuteness online and the way that cuteness is shaping our own, like, constitutions, I guess, in, I'm reminded of face filters, the way that we're literally cutifying our features. How do you think that's affecting desire and, like, digital desire and the way that we conceive ourselves and others?
Yeah, I think when you look at evolutionary psychology and sociobiology, aside from the fact that they have dubious political uses, they're very satisfying in terms of giving an explanation in the form of a simple story. So we like to read that something exists because it evolved that way, but they're in fact fraught with problems, and we go into some detail about why these aren't really satisfactory explanations for the cultural phenomena of cuteness. I mean, for a start, you have this idea that either, you know, the only way that evolutionary psychology can understand anything is in its relation to whether it favors reproduction or not, which to start with is a very limiting way to understand even the products of natural evolution, because they're not all useful in a simple sense. So in this recent Guardian article, I read this line which says, at the basic level, it's an evolutionary adaptation developed by babies so we don't abandon them for being useless, which sounds like a good story, but what happened to all the babies who existed before that evolutionary adaptation happened? Like, did they all die? It doesn't really make sense when you start thinking about it. And in fact, what you have, even in like the earliest writers about cuteness, particularly Konrad Lorenz, who invented this thing called the Kinchen schema, this kind of pattern of enlarged eyes and big head and so on. What you have is the realization that this has to be a kind of evolutionary feedback loop. The parents become more attuned to those features, and then those features become more pronounced, and then the parents become more attuned to them. And that happens over a long period. So the interesting thing about that is that even before we reach the stage of culture, cuteness is already this accelerative feedback loop. The only thing that limits that feedback loop is when it reaches an evolutionary stable state. And then the relay is taken up by culture, where you're producing like teddy bears and dolls and Pokemon and so on. But the evolutionary story is actually, I think, a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting. There's a particularly interesting author, Stephen Levinson, who talks about the fact that cuteness might have actually had an adaptational advantage in babies being appealing to people other than their parents. So if you If a baby is appealing to other people, and like other people apart from its parents are then attracted to pick it up and look after it, that frees up a lot of human social energy to be able to begin the process of developing those specifically human skills like language. So in this sense, he says, you know, cute is kind of a portal into humanness as such, into these things that we think of as quintessentially human. So there's all sorts of far more interesting speculations that you can make about the evolution of cuteness, I think.
Cuteness gets a lot of shade thrown on it as well, for like, especially in terms of 2D love, 2D romance, like people who fall in love with two-dimensional characters or have like anime lovers, because it's taking them out of the heterosexual reproductive human matrix. And they're not reproducing in the kind of normal way, and therefore they're like a risk to the human race, the human race's reproduction of itself. But I think that this is, again, like this whole evolutionary story of measuring everything in terms of heterosexual biological reproduction is just a really narrow way of measuring the value of anything. And cuteness is, as we've kind of tried to point out, it's actualizing all of these like virtual latent spaces around this evolutionary imperative, making these new forms of desire available, creating new technologies, pushing these other things into the 2.5D, that is going to change the way that humans reproduce themselves, reproduce culture, or even reproduce their descendants or AI future companions or whatever you want to see as that. In a way that is not just this like boring biofuturism, which, I mean, if you're just talking about reproducing humans in the same old like biological way as since forever, you're not really talking about futurism anyway. You're just talking about this reproduction of the same, this kind of infinite present. So I think cuteness is like incubating new desires and new technologies, which are going to actually take us away from biological reproduction. In a really interesting way. And that's why it's not just this kind of nostalgic mode. It's super futuristic. It's inhuman. And it's really synthetic.
The cuter something is, the more you want to engage with it. There's that term kawaii capitalism that describes that phenomena. And yeah, I think the ability of cuteness to shape a user's behavior, whether that's kind of creating engaging video games, or even that sound that kind of comes at the end of TikTok videos, that kind of incentivizes you to kind of keep scrolling, I guess, keeps you like on the platform.
Yeah, I mean, that also isn't news. So you have this very interesting figure, Rosie O'Neill, who in the early years of the 20th century, she invented the Kewpie doll and subsequently went on to use it in propaganda for like female suffrage. So there's been kind of a tradition for a long time of using cuteness as a vehicle for other causes, if you like. But I think for us, we're more interested in the force of cuteness itself and what it might make us do that we wouldn't otherwise do.
Well, I mean, there's the kind of universal experience of seeing a cute animal or a baby and like immediately lapsing into some kind of stupid baby talk that you would never use in any other situation, almost unconsciously. So cuteness has this kind of strange, it's often referred to as a mimetic power. It makes you react cutely in turn. And so just extrapolating from that really like fundamental universal impulse that, I mean, there's probably few people who haven't had that experience at some point. It has this contagious kind of aspect to it. And so the more that cuteness invades the internet, the more it saturates our culture, the less power we have to withstand also becoming cute.
Yeah, I think there are one great example of this would be the femboy culture on TikTok, which, you know, when you have a series of people telling each other that it's okay to give in and to be shameless and to act in a certain way that's goes very much against the kind of gender-coded tradition, that can be an extremely powerful thing. If you're just kind of being cute in your bedroom on your own, it's not quite the same thing. But when it's networked, it kind of becomes this force of, from one side, from the reactionary side, from the right-wing side, it looks like this terrible process of degeneracy and like social media plague. But from our point of view, it looks like an enterprise of liberation and exploration.
Yeah, no, that networked quality is really interesting to me, because I know what I find really interesting, what I've been thinking about a lot recently, is how cuteness kind of plays into the homogenizing online culture that exists now. I mean, I guess flashback to episode one and talking about the midness of culture. We live in a midocracy. And I guess the algorithm dictates what content we consume online, which then obviously affects our offline behavior as well. Like, we see this with microtrends, with all the girl suffix, like the cause, the waves, like even the way that we speak online is completely like dictated, at least on like TikTok and a lot of social media, by like, yeah, like what the algorithm, yeah, like basically the way that the algorithm kind of guides our behavior. It almost feels like an invisible hand in some way. But then I guess alongside this, we have cuteness as this extreme presence, which is also very networked as well. But like, cuteness almost feels like the opposite of flatness, or maybe not the opposite, but there feels like there's this definite kind of interplay of polarities where this kind of feedback of cuteness, I guess, is dancing alongside this kind of big flat sameness that we're experiencing culturally on the internet. So yeah, I guess what's cute's relationship to all of this? Like, how does this play out, do you think?
Yeah, I think cute is a kind of extreme vector. And that's what we call the cute process. But at the same time, there's obviously this kind of continual blockage of it, because what capitalism wants to do is to sell you stuff. So you get things like Funko Pops, which is like this kind of shitty frozen form of cuteness that you can't do anything with. Like, no one's ever going to hug a Funko Pop. So that kind of blocks the process of you interacting with it and allowing the cute into yourself. But a lot of what we're trying to do is to extrapolate from these objects that we see in culture around us to try and reach something like the ultimate abstract transcendental shape of cute. So like the kind of ultimate vibe, or the vanishing point where cute's going. And a lot of that has come not through kind of analyzing culture, but through, for me at least, a kind of sensory meditation on where cute leads us. So just like trying to concentrate really, really hard for a very long time on cute objects. So if I can talk about socks, because I'm kind of obsessed with socks. Socks are really interesting in relation to like the ultimate transcendental shape of cuteness, because they're all about rounding, smoothing, blunting the extremities. And cuteness is often about this kind of compactness, this squeezing, rounding things off, smoothing things off. And if you think about like the famous anthropologist Leroy Guron, he talks about the two technical organs, the two things that mark out humans from animals, which is the tongue and the hands. And it's really interesting that cuteness is really unhappy with both fingers and with speech. It tries to de-articulate as much as possible. And this is one thing that comes out, that cute in a sense is kind of regressive. When you get cute talk, it's this kind of regression back to childhood burbling, la-la kind of language. And it also doesn't like hands. It prefers paws, right? So cute has this kind of bluntness about it. So cuteness kind of paradoxically combines these apparently opposite qualities. And they're often also gendered qualities. So in this phenomenon of cute aggression, you have at once this kind of impulse to push into something, to kind of penetrate it. But at the same time, you have this nurturing kind of wanting to enfold it, to cover it, to protect it. And those are very kind of gendered qualities.
I think like in terms of like mixing up gender, Like it doesn't even stop there. So there's this like Japanese theorist, Haruki Izumo, who was writing a lot in the 90s, was kind of engaged in this like super flat moment, was very much about the postmodern. And he did this like postmodern reading of manga and anime fans at the time. And he kind of talks about how they produce and consume anime and manga, and they kind of make their own stories and sell them at comic cons and break down characters into like little elements of cuteness, which he calls moe elements. And he's kind of like thesis is that in the manga and anime fan world, in the otaku world, there's no longer the like modernist grand narrative. We don't tell ourselves coherent stories anymore. And there's not like an overarching story that all of the like, all of your little personal narratives about yourself and your life have to kind of like fit back into. Everything is broken up into these little interchangeable moe elements. So when you're like, you know, you've got your favorite manga character and you kind of, you like them because they have specific things, like because they have, cat's ears and they have antennae hair and they speak in a particular way. And then you take those three things, cat's ears, antennae hair and particular kind of speaking, and you maybe add them to another character and throw in a different thing. And it's like, instead of a narrative, we just have this database of all of these little bits and pieces. And he says that's what the kind of condition that we're living in is. And he sort of connects this to super flatness in terms of it's a postmodern repudiation of this like modernist aspiration for the grand narrative and to kind of transcend through narrative. But I think it's more interesting than that, because I think you start to see in the way that anime and manga culture has infiltrated online culture and a global first world psyche in general, people starting to repeat these moe elements in the way that they present themselves online. So people wearing cat ears or tails, speaking in a particular way, like long socks, saggy socks, like there's a whole kind of like list of these like really classic moe tropes. And they start to take the place of gender performance. So instead of like producing yourself as a particular gendered person, you're picking from this database of all of these little bits and pieces, rearranging them until you find a way that they fit with your identity and your body and the way you present yourself to make this new character. And the interesting thing about all these elements is that they're like, some of them are animal elements, some of them are machine elements, some of them are plant elements. They cross like all of these different realms. And so we're kind of, I think cuteness is like not just breaking down binary gender, but actually transporting us into this weird post-human world where gender is just broken into fragments that are not even human-coded fragments anymore. So I kind of see this as one of the places that cute culture is taking us, and otaku culture in Azuma's reading of it as being this kind of early harbinger of how that sort of close feedback loop of culture and production starts to make this happen.
Yeah, and this is in a sense in which cuteness can operate as a kind of giving permission and license for you to explore your map of your own body and the way that you appear to others and to yourself. So it's not simply a matter of kind of creating representations. It can also be feedback into your creation of yourself as an exploratory strategy. You know, you can be a goth girl with big boots and cat ears.
There is like a shape-shifting quality to cuteness, and as we've mentioned before as well, it allows you to play with what's real, what's not real. It blurs the like boundaries between fantasy and reality. And I know, I feel like that's also related, and there's something I want to touch on as well, the kind of artificiality and synthetic qualities of what it means to be cute as an aesthetic. I guess going back to music examples like PC Music or collectives like Drain Gang, a lot of SoundCloud rap definitely draws on this artificiality like the sounds themselves are very extreme, like they're definitely not middle ground, and they're also like incredibly artificial as well. And yeah, I guess it's that shape-shifting quality that really draws you in, which does also feel innately cute, and you can see that reflected in the kind of, I guess, J-pop inspirations and also the aesthetics as well. Like they are very like glossy, and that's like, if you see like all the cute pilled memes online, they all have that very kind of saturated, kind of white faded, like sparkly aesthetic to them, which is synthetic. And I guess my question would be, how does this play into our self-conceptions of our own identities? Like, especially kind of looking at how this relates to our like digital identities and how that carries out into the offline world.
Yeah, and also an increasingly plastic world. And, you know, when a kind of right-wing reactionaries look at this kind of culture and say, you know, you're not actually doing anything, you're just pretending that there are different genders, you're just pretending that you can be this and that. I think that's kind of missing the point, which is that the culture itself is driving and producing the means to greater plasticity all the time. So really, this whole book is about transformation and the fact that we're kind of trying to tear down a whole legacy of received morality, and that cuteness is to do with getting beyond shamelessness, getting beyond the identity that you were given. And there's this line in the book where we say cuteness begins with shamelessness, and shamelessness is the beginning of transformation. So as soon as you drop your need to be adult and serious to live in the supposedly real world, then all these possibilities open up, all these transformations open up. And that's really to do with plasticity. And what is it that people who don't like cartoons don't like? It's the fact that cartoons aren't real and that everything moves in ways that are impossible. It's the plasticity. So really this kind of question of plasticity and, kind of producing yourself as a plastic being is something that is really at the center of not just online culture, but of a kind of culture wars at the moment, I think.
Yeah, and I guess on the topic of culture wars as well, like, I think the dark side of cuteness is very unavoidable these days online. I guess one of the main examples, and in the last few years, there's been so many like memes of anime girls like holding big guns. There's lots of stuff about the kind of relationship between cuteness and violence. But I wrote an article last year that focuses predominantly on, I guess, the phenomenon of e-girls within the military. It was focusing mostly on the US military, but I guess we're also seeing it with Israel as well. But I guess all this touches on this idea of cuteness being weaponized all around us as this kind of tranquilizing force to coerce, to control, to consume, albeit with sparkly hearts and emojis. But yeah, I guess reframing violence as something cutesy and unthreatening, which seems quite, creepy in some ways.
Totally.
Yeah. I think in the end, we tried to distinguish between the use or exploitation of cuteness for cunning human reasons, which have always existed, and cute's own cunning, like cute's ingress into our world, and trying to ask, what does cute want to do with us? We don't really know yet. So yeah, there's no doubt that cuteness, like any kind of form of human relational behavior, can be used for ingenious or nefarious ends. But our primary interest is the extent to which the dynamic of cute is kind of repurposing human behavior in ways that don't any longer respond to pre-existing or traditional human ends. And that's why it's accelerationist. That's why it's cute accelerationism and not just cute studies.
Yeah, it really reminds me of, this is really overused, but what they say about AI, about how it's kind of like a knife in that, you know, it can harm people, it can save people, or it's literally just a knife. And I feel like you can really apply the same with cuteness as well. Like, obviously, there's the good sides, the bad sides, but it's also banal as well. Like, it's not necessarily loaded either way. I do want to touch on or get your opinion on the future of cuteness. Like, where is this all going? I know you've mentioned AI previously, but I guess, yeah, we have AI companions. As this technology kind of advances, you know, there's Replica, which is bringing about AI girlfriends. Also, as our lives are kind of increasingly mediated by the digital, we are becoming increasingly post-human. And so, yeah, where do you see this all going? Like, can things get more cute than they already are? Can things get cuter? I don't know.
You know, cuteness is an accelerative force, and it continues to produce ever more poignant, refined, aggressive versions of itself, which we never could have imagined existing, right? And AI is just going to be another step in increasing the plasticity of the forms that we're playing with and introducing new mechanisms that can automatically produce things that are cuter than we could ever imagine. You know, this the kind of idea of latent spaces and the idea that machines can actually discover things within the unconscious of human culture that we could like possibly never pull out is an interesting one. And then the other thing is, you know, we interact with each other on this kind of flat plane so much that it's now not really that unnatural to interact with an AI, you know, with ChatGPT or whatever, and to form a relationship with it over text. And that's now moving into speech and being able to speak to your virtual boyfriend or girlfriend. And undoubtedly that kind of trend will continue. And, you know, when we're talking about accelerationism, the kind of classic theory of accelerationism had this whole kind of grim, dark aesthetic to it that was based on Terminator and the idea that, like, the future was coming to get you in the form of a metallic skull that was going to drag you into this accelerated future. And what we've got to realize is that that was a profound misjudgment. And the way in which the future is infiltrating the present is through cuteness, through affection, and through love. These are all the kind of soft buttons that Skynet is pressing in order to make us build it.
Like, that's a great place to round off. I feel incredibly big-brained right now. But Amy Meyer, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. This has been super enlightening and very cute. And as for the listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. This is Logged On. Please like, subscribe. You can find us wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. And see you on the next episode.
Logged On.